Hell yeah, bruh. Throw on some tall. Welcome back to another episode of Lyrics for Lunch, the show that always minds our mother's words.
Ha! Yes, we do.
And this is a show that brings you the unforgettable stories from your favorite songs and artists. We sometimes ruin songs and artists for people, but I hope we don't do that today. My name's Aviv Rubenstein. I am one of your two hosts. Joining me, as always, the Colin Malloy to my Ben Gibbard. She likes it when I say her name. I forget
every
that you like
time.
It when I
say it. How can you forget?
Because I always know that I do it wrong, and then my instinct is to
introduce
do it.
Introduce me.
Is
just
to do it wrong.
Me. Just
I don't even know who you are. Lindsay Tucker.
Have we met? Hi.
112 episodes
here.
In.
Good to be here. 112th episode. Woohoo!
A big milestone. I'm doing well. My refrigerator stopped working, so if anyone wants to go to lyricsforlunch.com and click on support the show, I need a new compressor coil or something.
Woof.
So please help me. Or I'll take, if you want to send me like a record or Blu-ray or something, I'll take whatever.
Just send a V free stuff.
Send me stuff.
I'll take some stuff.
Yeah, Lindsay will also take some stuff. How are you, Lindsay? How is your refrigerator? Is your refrigerator running?
Better go catch it.
Better catch it.
My refrigerator is old, and Ooh. It's still kicking.
Still kicking.
Should have got the home warranty.
I wait.
Do you have one?
I have homeowner's insurance.
Mm-mm.
Home warranty.
It's quite cheap. Like, I don't know why more people don't get home warranties, because let's say it was like $250 for the year. Like, mm-hmm. everything in my house
my
fucking broke.
Shit. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
This episode is brought to you by Home Warranties.
Yeah, get one. Anyway, what are we talking about today?
Today, perplexingly to me, we're talking about the song The Shank Hill Butchers by the band The Decemberists. It is The Decemberists. Don't tell me to drop the.
I wasn't going to.
I could feel it. I could feel your eyes telling me to drop the. Mm-hmm. Which is a song that I know really, really well, and a band that I know really, really well, and I didn't realize that there was anything there. And so I'm super interested in learning what I have been missing this whole time.
Hooray. That's what I'm here for.
Hooray.
All right. So you love the Decemberists. So who are the Decemberists?
I do. I loved past tense the Decemberists. So the Decemberists
yeah.
were a band that were like this kind of art rock, art folk band that specialized in very esoteric, complicated, wordy lyrics, and they got kind of they broke onto the mainstream with a couple of albums, Picaresque, and which is like 2005-ish, and then The Crane Wife, which is like a concept album about some Chinese myth about the crane wife.
Colin Malloy told Pitchfork or Rolling Stone like he didn't want it to be called a concept album because concept albums could never like live up to.
Shut up, Colin. I'm sure I'm gonna say this numerous times today, but shut up, Colin. Right, so non-concept album, concept album, but there's like Crane Wife part 1, 2, and 3 on the record, but it like starts with part 3.
1 and 2 is the same song, kind of.
Yeah, it's
the same
weird.
Track number, I think,
but There's like a ton of. There are no
crane
like.
Wife.
That's exactly what it sounds like. There's a ton of like overlapping stories and motifs, and like one specific song is like in 4 parts, which I think part of that is the Shank Hill Butchers, or is that its own song? Let me look at the track listing.
Yeah.
But
Shank Hill is its own song.
Our song of the week is on. The reason I'm talking about this is because our song of the week is on this record, and I really like this record. a lot. I remember specifically, this is my I've been kind of quietly hiding the secret. I'm very anti-Connecticut. And I remember...
Hates the buttered lobster roll.
That's okay. But I think Connecticut's main export is traffic. And so I was once driving back up to college circa 2006-ish with my friends. And we got...
In the old 95 or the Merritt Parkway Drive?
I think probably 95. And we were stuck in traffic in Connecticut. And we listened to the entire Crane Wife album sitting in traffic without moving. Like, we didn't move once during the entire album.
Like, not even an inch.
Maybe like a one car length in the hour long time that we were sitting there. It was so slow that my mother had baked me brownies for the trip up, and we got out of the car on the side of the road, and it didn't. You know, nothing was moving, and we just shared brownies with people in the other cars.
Yeah, I've been in those traffic jams on 95.
Yeah, not a huge fan of Connecticut traffic, but yeah, that's what this record reminds me of. We start with Crane Wife 3, first album, first song on the album, and then Crane Wife 1 and 2 comes later. Perfect Crime number 2, track 5. Perfect Crime number 1, nowhere to be found. It's on the B-sides.
Great album, right?
I really do like this album. The four-part song that I was referring to is called The Island, Come and See, The Landlord's Daughter, and You'll Not Feel the Drowning.
Love it.
Yeah, which I saw them live.
Like
it rips.
Drowning.
Yeah. It's not a concept album. It's a drowning album.
So let me just go over some of the notes that we skipped over with Aviv's retelling of the Decemberists. The Decemberists are an American indie rock band from Portland.
Oh, right. Portland. Yeah. I feel like Portland was implied, but not explicitly stated.
The band is made up of Colin Malloy, who we have mentioned. He's the lead vocalist. He plays guitar and does most of the songwriting. Then we also have Chris Funk on the guitar and instruments. Jenny Conley plays piano, keyboards, accordion, and also sings.
She rips. I saw them live, and specifically during this The Island Come and See song, like, basically set the organ on fire. She was just so good.
Were they at Newport like that year that we were both there?
Yes, they were. They headlined it, but this was after their star had faded, and I didn't stick around to see them.
Oh, lame.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so who else? We had Nate Query on bass and John Moen on drums.
Yeah.
So the band formed in 2000 when Colin Malloy left his previous band, Tarkio, which was in Montana, and then he moved to Portland, where he met the bassist Nate Query, and Query introduced Colin Malloy to Jenny Conley, and then the three of them scored a silent film together and formed the Decemberists.
It's not silent if there's a score, Colin.
Are you sure? Like,
no, Charlie, that's absolutely not music? True. They all had music.
Okay.
Colin.
So what do you think the Decemberists band name is about?
Oh, so I know this, and I was looking for an opportunity to tell this story.
Oh, too. Were you now?
So this goes to one of our great listeners, Sky Mazeroski, was in a band called Forrest Henderson. We've played them on the show. I've talked about them a few times. When I couldn't place that Elvis Costello song a few episodes back, I texted their guitarist, Matt Ott, and their lead singer, Billy Hubbard, told me the story that when they were forming the band in like 2002, 2003, they had narrowed their name down to two options: Forrest Henderson, which I think was the name of their history teacher, a la Leonard Skinnerd, and the Decemberists. And they like did a quick Google or whatever that was in 2002 to see if that name had been taken, and it was. So I know through Billy and through that band that it's about the December Revolution in Russia. Is that right?
The Decembrist Revolt, 1825 insurrection in Imperial Russia.
In Russia. It was like one of the failed revolutions before the Bolsheviks took over in 1917.
All right. So Malloy has also stated that the name the Decembrist is meant to invoke the, quote, drama and melancholy of the month of December, which is a bit like foreshadowing for the lyrical storytelling that the Decembrists are known for.
Sure. He's like, he like heard the early November and he's like, I'll do one better.
And like, I don't really, aside from the long December song, like, what is so bad about December? Like, there's fucking Christmas lights everywhere. I love it.
You know, winter, cold, darkness, especially when you're in the Pacific Northwest. Well, the shortest day of the year is in December. And if you're in the Pacific Northwest, that's like 2 hours of sunlight.
Yeah, fine. So do you have a favorite song of the Decemberists?
Yeah, Long December.
Nope.
By the Decemberists.
By the Counting Crows.
Is it
Counting Crows? Yeah.
Counting Crows. Drop the.
Not the other crows. Black Crows.
Black Crows, no. And I also learned today that the Black Crows is C-R-O-W-E-S. No, I definitely emphasized the wrong letter there. C-R-O-W-E-S, like Cameron Crowe.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Lyrics for lunch, baby.
Went to see the Black Crows on my 21st birthday.
Okay,
at
so
Lupo's,
what?
Heartbreak Hotel.
I asked you
what's your favorite song.
I'm looking at a list of December songs. I'm trying to tell you. I think I probably have to go with the Mariner's Revenge song, which is the last song on Picaresque.
We almost did that song today. Fun fact.
Yeah, it's.
But once I was researching, and I was like, I'm asleep.
Yeah, it is a 9-minute song that just like tells the story of a sailor getting eaten by a whale, and it's like one of those kind of novelty songs that I listened to a lot in like 2006 or so. I really like basically all of the Crane Wife. Oh, Valencia is really great off the Crane Wife, which is one of my favorites. I don't know. I have a lot of. We Both Go Down Together is good. 16 Military Wives is good. Sorry, the Mariner's Revenge is not the last song on Picaresque. Of Angels and Angles is, and that is a real skip for me. Sporting Life's good. Eli the Barrow Boy is good. Those two records, Picaresque and Crane Wife, are my, those are the ones I really, really love. And then I'm not super familiar with earlier stuff. There's a song, I think it's called Myla Goldberg, and one of my favorite lines of theirs is, I know New York, I need New York, I know I need unique New York, which I thought was very, very clever. I also like A Cautionary Tale, which is, he tells the story about how he wrote that song in Boston.
What's cautionary the one song? About like where the guy is murdering all his kids? Is that that's not Cautionary Tale.
Basically, fucking all of them. Cautionary Song is about the mother who's like a prostitute.
Oh, the Rake Song. The Rake Song is
is very good too. Yeah, all of them feel very like 19th century like gothic literature shit. Mm-hmm. They should have been in Saltburn.
I haven't watched that yet.
Oh, it's good. Someone fucks a grave.
Okay, so between 2000 and 2004, Decemberists put out 3 records, and they label hopped a bit before Capitol Records picked them up for the Crane Wife, the album that we've kind of just been rambling about for quite a while.
Yeah,
and that was their 4th album, and Pitchfork called it their finest album to date, quote, allowing the band to retain its quirks and furnishing them with a budget ample enough to realize their most ambitious, epically proportioned ideas.
We have enough budget for a hammered dulcimer now.
Malloy told Pitchfork that while creating the Crane Wife, quote, I was listening mostly to British folk revival stuff from the 70s. I was listening to a lot of Pentacle and Shirley Collins and Fairport Convention. I think that really is what drove me in this direction. But Jenny is a huge Jethro Tull and ELP fan, so I think she was excited to
throw
go crazy
on some Tull.
All over the album. This record, more than any other, has showed off the various influences of the other members of the band as much as mine. So Pitchfork says, you seem as interested in the basic forms of storytelling, the way narrative elements play out toward an inevitable denouement.
Denouement. Pronounce none of the consonants, none of the vowels. Denouement. Perfect. Perfect French.
As you are the stories and characters themselves. So what is a denouement?
Denouement is a French word for basically the resolution of a story. So we have the climax, and then the breath out after the climax is the denouement.
Okay, so the elements played out toward an inevitable climax as you are the stories and characters themselves. Do you think the two constructs, stories and how they're told, can even be bifurcated that way, or are they inextricable?
Man, shut up, whoever this is, too.
Why? When, giving me when, a real mouthful.
When you sit down with Colin Malloy, you don't have to talk like him.
Right? Damn. So Malloy says back to that question, as important as it is in novels or short stories to have well-developed characters, it's just as important to abide by a strong narrative arc where you have development and crisis and conflict and resolution. I think it's just another university that people like to have their stories given to them that way. So yes, the way the story is told is really important because I think the story then dictates the lives of the characters.
You wouldn't ask this of someone who writes a novel or TV or movies. It's just like, oh, you know, these characters aren't actually real, right? And so, like, why are we telling the story?
Like, and also, they're like calling out the basic concept of storytelling. Well, you know, there has to be like conflict and resolution and stuff. Like,
yeah, why would you ask literally anyone that?
Yeah, that was strange. But I just wanted to set up like the way the Decemberist music is talked about and the. Yeah. How their lyrics are, I don't know, like deciphered, because now we're going to listen to the Shankill Butchers.
2, 3, 4.
Colin Malloy does the singing in cursive thing that a lot of like the twee bedroom indie pop the girls do now. He sings like his tongue's too big for his mouth.
Does he?
You better shut your windows tight.
Yeah.
I guess I could hear it.
They're sharpening their cleavers and their knives, and taking all their whiskey by the pint. 'Cause everybody knows, if you don't mind your mother's words, a wicked wind will blow your ribbons from your curls. Everybody moan, everybody shake. The Shankill Butchers wanna catch you away.
We don't really make albums like this anymore. There's like no, like, pop single on this. Maybe Valencia. That's it.
Yeah.
They used to be just like me and you. They used to be sweet little boys. But something went horribly askew. Now killing is their only source of joy. Is everybody knows, if you don't mind your mother's words, a wicked wind will blow your ribbons from your curls. Everybody moan, everybody shake. Shankill Butchers wanna catch you away.
So, what is this song about, Aviv?
You're gonna talk through this incredible dulcimer solo?
I don't have to. The fretted dulcimer.
The fretted dulcimer. That's exactly what they're playing right now. Which, like, speaks to, you know, we had our fretted dulcimer conversation in our Oliver Anthony episode talking about, like, Appalachian folk music, which, like, this is that, right? They're, like, doing kind of old-timey, folky, sit-around-a-fire story songs. Murder ballads.
Murder ballads.
Murder ballads.
Yeah. Scary stories to tell in the dark.
Yeah.
Mind you, mother.
I also kind of like this languid percussion that's like a little behind the beat, stomping on the 2 and 4.
And why do you like it?
I just like it. It adds like a cool vibe to the song.
Yeah, what does it make you feel?
The stomping of a chain gang, yeah. Right? Are we doing like, you know...
Yeah, the Marleys.
The lost souls of the Shankill Butchers coming to kill little kids. See, ask me again.
Ask me again.
I know. I knew that you would do that. Ask me again. You want to go to Morocco?
Okay, what is this song about?
Beyond, like, the text, right, which is that there are these people who are marauding the normal neighborhoods, killing children who are not asleep in their beds at night, right? You better mind your mother's words and go to sleep, or else the Shankill Butchers will get you, which feels like kind of a companion to a cautionary song, which is on a couple albums earlier, and it has like a similar vibe. It's there's a place your mother goes where everybody else is soundly sleeping through the lights of Beacon Street, and if you listen, you can hear her weeping because the gentlemen are calling and the snow is softly falling on her petticoat. She's standing in the harbor and she's waiting for the sailors on the jolly boat, see how they approach. And it's like, you know, go to bed because
mommy's
gonna... mom's a prostitute. I think that it's that. It's like a bedtime spook story.
Do you want to do a dramatic reading?
Of Shankill Butchers?
Yeah.
I would love to. Because I just did half of a different song.
2, 3, 4.
That's what your contribution to this?
Yes.
The Shankill Butchers ride tonight. You better shut your windows tight. They're sharpening their cleavers and their knives and taking all their whiskeys by the pint. Because everybody knows, if you don't mind your mother's words... a wicked wind will blow your ribbons from your curls. Everybody moan, everybody shake. The Shankill Butchers want to catch you awake.
They used to be just like me and you. They used to be sweet little boys, but something went horribly askew. Now killing is their only source of joy.
Because everybody knows, if you don't mind your mother's words.
And then the Shankill Butchers on the rise. They're waiting until the dead of night. They're picking at their fingers with their knives and wiping off their cleavers on their thighs.
And our last kind of moment is the Shankill Butchers want to catch you. The Shankill Butchers want to cut you. The Shankill Butchers want to catch you awake. So yeah, to me, it was always a go-to-bed story, a go-to-bed song, which like... this, I mean, my parents never did this to me, like, scare me into sleeping, but, yeah. Like, how is that effective?
Does that work?
Yeah.
It's like Santa Claus, but worse.
I'm calling Santa Claus right now.
So, in the this is back to Pitchfork, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Pitchfork says...
You said okay, like, this is about to make me furious.
In Shanekill Butchers, you took a real specific event and stripped away every ounce of socio-political content, then remade it as an abstract meditation on violence and terror. Can you tell our readers about the real Shanekill Butchers and how you became interested in them?
So I didn't know that there were real Shanekill Butchers.
Don't worry, I'll tell you.
Thank you. Well, this is a mind blower for me.
Already. So Colin Malloy says, I was reading the Van Morrison biography by Johnny Rogan last summer. I was in Ireland, and there's a section where he talks about the political issues in Northern Ireland, which included a section on the Shanekill Butchers. The Shanekill Butchers were a group of Protestant men who at night would get wasted and then get cleavers and their butcher knives and go out to attack Catholics. This was in the 70s. At least one of their victims.
The 70s?
Yeah.
This late isn't the 1770s?
Late 70s.
Star Wars had come out, and there are these roving gangs of Protestants with cleavers murdering people in their homes.
Correct. Like, survivors are still alive. So at least this is still Malloy. At least one of their victims was hung up by his feet and skinned alive. Really horrific. Apparently, parents at the time would actually use it as a cautionary tale and tell their kids that if they didn't eat their greens or do what they were told, the Shanekill Butchers would come and get them. I've spoken to Irish people who remember that as kids growing up at the time. So it struck me as something that has such fairy tale proportions that it's timeless in its horror.
It's so interesting because this goes back to like how the story is told versus the subject matter of the story. Like, the internet kind of existed when the story takes place, where, you know, these people are, you know, Star Wars and whatever other, we'd been to the moon. And yet the way that, we had been to the moon, or supposedly we'd been to a studio in Burbank, and yet the way that the song is presented through the instrumentation and the melody and everything else, it sounds like a 17th century pirate song.
It does.
Yeah.
Well, today I will bring you the true story of the Shanekill Butchers, not pirates.
Not pirates. 70s. Okay, cool. This is going to bum me the fuck out.
So it was November 25th, 1975, that Francis Croissant.
Nope, we're gonna start over.
Francis Croissant.
Croissant.
A 34-year-old father of two and a Catholic from Belfast, birthplace of the Titanic, with no affiliation to any paramilitary organizations, became the first civilian to have his throat cut by the Shanekill Butchers. During the most provocative times of the Troubles, he became the first of many to die viciously at the hands of the Shanekill Butcher gang. So, Aviv, I ask you, what are the Troubles?
What are the Troubles? Man, fuck you for making me do this. So the Troubles speaks to a time in the 20th century where there was violence between the Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, and Ireland proper, which is not part of the United Kingdom. And the deal is basically based on the split from England, from the Catholic Church, that England is now a Protestant country so that Henry VIII could get divorced. And primarily the religious lines get drawn that Northern Ireland is mostly Protestant, Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, is Catholic. But that doesn't mean that everyone in each place is of that religion. And so in the 20th century, there were, you know, lots of fighting. Some people were trying to unify Ireland. Some people were trying to remain in the UK. The term Irish car bomb, the drink, comes from a practice of the Irish Republican Army blowing up cars in order to, I don't know, not a great time in that region.
Also, like, leave it to human beings to make alcoholism always about bombings. Like, Beirut became beer pong.
Oh, right. I never called it Beirut. That doesn't make any sense. But yeah, in Ireland, if you order like an Irish car bomb in a pub, they will not be happy. It's like it would be like ordering a 9/11 drink, which I would do.
I got to ask my dad about this because he came back from Ireland and he was like, oh, yeah, we were drinking a lot of like Guinness and Jameson. And I was like, a car bomb? And he was like, no.
You don't call it that.
Well, I don't think he was dropping it in.
Right,
either.
Right. And a shotgun, your dad shotgunning a Guinness and a whiskey. Russ parties, man.
Russ does party. He parties pretty hard. I can't always keep up with them.
Right on.
So, okay, yeah. So basically the Troubles was the conflict that Aviv mentioned. It ran from 1968 to about 1998.
Yeah, the show Dairy Girls takes place kind of during the end of the Troubles.
All right. So Northern Ireland.
Protestant.
Were the they had Protestants, the Loyalists, so-called, air quotes, right?
Loyalists / Royalists, yeah.
They wanted to remain part of the UK, and then Roman Catholics were the Nationalists / Republicans who wanted Northern Ireland to become part of the Republic of Ireland. And then we had some other major players in this conflict, the British Army, the Royal Ulster Constabulary.
Yeah, cops, coppers.
The Ulster Defense Regiment, the UDR. Who were called the Royal Irish Regiment after 1992. And yeah, so there's street fighting, sensational bombing, sniper attacks, roadblocks, internment without trial. The Britannica says that the confrontation had the characteristics of a civil war despite its textbook categorization of a low-intensity conflict.
Yeah, and technically it's not a civil war because they're like two different country. It's super weird. And there's also like a group of organizations that like the Royalists classified as terrorist organizations, like the IRA and Sinn Féin, and the Nationalists, the Irish Nationalists, would refer to as like freedom fighters. I have a predictably, if you know my politics at all, a predictably consistent kind of point of view on the subject. So yeah.
Yeah, did we hit all the points
of the Troubles?
Yeah,
I mean, yes and no. Like, so the potato famine, which happened several long time before the Troubles officially began or unofficially began. When I was growing up, I was taught that there was a famine in Ireland. And they only had potatoes left to eat. And
yeah, we learned that in public school.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the reality is that England stole all their crops. It was like a manufactured famine. They tried to starve the nation of Ireland. So this, much like many other, you know, conflicts that are going on in the world today, like the further back you zoom out, like, it starts before it starts, always. And you can zoom out even further and even further and even further, and it's just like a forever swamp of the people in power exerting horrific violence over the people that don't have power.
Correct. And this is the backdrop to which the Shankill Butchers are operating against.
Yes. Against.
In front of.
In front. Right. Yes. Okay. Understood.
Okay. That's the scene that they're in.
Yes, right. Because they are Protestants. They're killing Catholics that live in Northern Ireland just because they're like, you might be a nationalist, even though you live here in Belfast.
As far as I know, most of their victims were not even. They were not even Catholic. No, they were Catholic. There was a few times they got it wrong and they got a couple Protestants, but they were not super like highly political people. It was like, oh, we know that like the people that go to this mass go to this bar afterwards. Mm-hmm. And then on their way home, they would get attacked.
Sure. They just wanted to make it generally unfavorable for Catholics to live in anywhere in Northern Ireland.
Right. So this is according to the West Cork People newspaper. The 12-man gang, now other accounts will say like it was up to 20 roving members, you know, there was like a core three or four and then rotating, you know, so it's somewhere between 12 and 20 men known as the Shankill Butchers. They rose during the Troubles. They operated for 7 years between 1975 and 1982.
We are almost alive during yes. this. Holy shit.
They were operating out of the Protestant West Belfast, and they were members of a loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF, which I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Their leader, Lenny Murphy, was said to have had, quote,
wait, you mean to tell me that a dude named Murphy is at the center of this?
Of course. And I meant to look this up. Like, do you think the Dropkick Murphys were named after this guy? Like,
oh, maybe. I mean, there are enough Irish people named Murphy that, like, who knows?
There's a ton
who knows,
of Murphys.
Who knows which Murphy
sure.
we're dropkicking?
But he was a very hated Murphy.
And honestly, like, not so removed from the time that the Dropkick Murphys are forming.
Right. Murphy has a, quote, seething hatred of Catholics. He's 5'6" tall.
Hell yeah. We stand a short king.
And by some accounts, he carried out the murders to compensate for his rumored Catholic origins by becoming a, quote, super prod.
Oh, sure. Like a Hitler thing, right?
Yeah.
The rumor is that Hitler had like a Jewish grandparent. And so he's just like extra anti-Semitic. Once again, cool.
Religion. So awesome. Not made up at
being,
all.
I hate being Catholic so much that I have to murder all the Catholics is a stance.
Yeah, that's a strong one. So Murphy was born in 1952. He grew up in the almost exclusively Protestant / Unionist Shankill Road area of Belfast.
I'm sorry, I can't get over this. This guy is younger than my mother.
Yeah.
Sorry for putting your age on blast, Mom, but what the fuck? Just like play piano in your retirement like my mother does. And don't do murders like my mother does.
No.
Shosh. She's a wanted criminal.
Murphy was said to be violent from a young age. He threatened other kids with a knife at school, I guess. Some people say.
Cool.
Some people say. And he committed petty crimes. Almost as soon as he finished school, he joined the UVF. And he was involved in rioting in Belfast in 1969. Even then, people recall that his hatred for Catholics was, like, abnormally vicious, and he talked about it too much. It was, like, his main topic of conversation.
Get a new thing. There's an interesting quote. There's this guy named Brennan Lee Mulligan who is a... He, like, plays D&D professionally. He's, like, a comedian. But he was talking about how... I think I may have mentioned this on the show before, too. That in his experience, people fill their political ideology based on their personality and not vice versa, right? So like assholes were assholes before they were fascists. And it seems
sure.
like this is the case with Murphy, right? Like he was a little shit and then found the political ideology that would justify him
where
being
it's
a little
okay
shit.
To be like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1000%. You've never, I mean, my politics are showing, but like I've never seen like a super compassionate, sweet
Republican
out there,
like, Lincoln.
Well, that was like before the flip-flop.
Yeah, right.
Unfortunately, the terror that Murphy would inflict for nearly a decade could have been entirely prevented because one of his earliest murders or earlier murders was carried out in broad daylight. He shot a 32-year-old Protestant named William Pavis in the head in front of witnesses.
I hate that we started that sentence with one of his earlier murders and it just got worse from there. How old was he when he shot this dude in broad daylight?
Oh, like in his 20s.
Cool.
23.
Okay. Old enough to be a murderer, I guess.
Well, yeah, but
he's murdering at a 10th grade level.
I think he was 23 when he got acquitted for this murder. So he could have been like 20.
Spoilers.
So click on this link and let me introduce what this is. This is a little clip from a YouTube documentary called Serial Killers, The Shankill Butchers. And we're gonna watch a little clippy clip from that now.
How Murphy got away with it tells us a lot about the man who went on to mastermind the killings of the Shankill Butchers. Murphy was charged alongside his getaway driver, Mervyn Connor. He named Murphy as the killer.
Very badly done documentary.
Amazingly, they were put on the same wing in Crumlin Road Jail. But just 2 months before the trial, Murphy's major accuser was dead, killed by cyanide. Beside him, an apparent suicide note.
Apparent suicide
note? Now, this is a copy of the note, and it's never been made public before. To whom it may concern, during my time in prison, I've done nothing but think what I've done to the fellow called and the names redacted.
We know Mervyn Connor is writing about Murphy. Here, on the day he was poisoned, he says naming Murphy as the killer was a lie he couldn't live with. The police conclusion? Murphy made sure he didn't have to.
It was common knowledge that Murphy had been responsible for Connor's death.
There's Murphy.
Common knowledge.
A very, very extremely cunning man. Could adjust to any circumstances in which he found himself. Murphy probably threatened to kill him if he didn't do it. He was totally ruthless.
That's why I didn't pull more from this documentary, because I was like, they're trying to like make a mountain out of a molehill. Like he was definitely like pulling strings from in jail, and throughout the story, he went to jail more times, and he was still like in charge of his gang. You know, that's just how gangs work.
Yeah.
So multiple witnesses saw him shoot and kill Pavis, and then the main guy the driver who said it was him dies in prison with a suicide note that he either wrote or was coerced to write or
didn't write, and Murphy wrote it for him.
Yeah. So that was the evidence that they used to acquit Murphy in 1973. He was 23 years old. He's getting a reputation. It's thought that at this point, he's killed at least 10 people already.
It's also like this adds to his cult of personality, which is like he shot this dude in broad daylight and like walked. So now he's like way too big for his britches.
And what do you do when you're too big for your britches? You assemble a crew of henchmen.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ, you guys.
So we have Robert Basher Bates. 25 years old.
Tell me they all have nicknames.
Nope, just Basher.
Damn it.
Sorry.
Basher's my favorite.
Sam McAllister and William Moore. They're all, so Basher's 25, McAllister's 20, William Moore 25. They all have substantial criminal records. William Moore drove a black taxi, which becomes important later in the story.
Sure.
And he had worked as a meat packer, which is allegedly how he stole the butcher's knives and meat cleavers.
They were literal butchers? Used.
Yes.
Holy shit.
For their tortures.
Oh, God. Okay.
So, November 25th, 1975, the body of 35-year-old Francis Croissant is found. Croissant, whatever. Still oozing from the throat. He had been walking toward the city center when he was hit over the head with a wheel brace and dragged into the taxi, taken to the Shankill area where he was brutally beaten. During the attack, a glass bottle was shoved into his head. He was then dragged into an alley off Wimbledon Street where Murphy used a butcher's knife to cut his throat almost through the spine.
Oh my God.
There had been violence in the streets, but like something was a little bit different about this one.
Okay.
This is the last time we're going to hear from this shitty documentary.
It was different. It was so savage, so barbaric. We'd come across people being stabbed, attacks with knives. This man obviously had been overpowered and his throat deliberately slit open. Evil is the only way you could describe it. Just evil.
Evil. In the mid-70s, during the Troubles, the police and other security forces were already pretty stretched pretty thin.
Sure.
by violence of Republican and Loyalist paramilitary gangs. And so they kind of turned a blind eye at first to the Shankill Butcher violence. It kind of was just like part of the backdrop. And many members of the gang were said to be members of UVF, and their victims were often drunk, walking home from the pub. They'd get abducted, beaten, tortured, and then they'd have their throats cut. So night after night, the Shankill Butchers are cruising the streets in the black taxi, abducting people.
It's so, the throats cut is interesting to me, because that's usually like, if we talk about like mob lingo, because they clearly want to be this like gang, right? And that usually means like someone has like squealed, right? You mm-hmm. cut their throat because, you know, they dimed on you. This just feels like he likes cutting throats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he does.
He's the guy that pulls the wings off a fly.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah.
So journalist Martin Dillon, he is the author of The Shankill Butchers, The Real Story of Cold-Blooded Mass Murder, wrote that Murphy, quote, hacked through his victim's throat until the knife touched the spine or until the head was almost severed from the trunk. And over the next several years, he and his gang continued to kill in this manner. In some instances, the victims were found with their necks slashed to the point of decapitation, but others had been brutally hacked to death with axes. A few victims had gunshot wounds from drive-by shootings, and a couple were unionist paramilitary members that the gang killed as part of personal disputes. And then randomly, there was like a couple Protestants who were mistaken as Catholics. The vast majority were just simply Catholic civilians who had no connection to any paramilitary activity, that they were just simply killed because they happened to be out on the streets at night when the butchers were hunting for Catholics.
That's so fucked.
Yeah. Okay, so May 1977, we're flying through the history here. This guy named Gerard McClaverty. McClaverty, 24 years old. He's forced into a car while he's walking down the street. Spoilers, it's the butchers. They take him to an abandoned...
What a twist!
They take him to an abandoned, like, surgery room, like an old hospital. And they beat him with sticks, and they stab him, and they slash his wrists.
Yeah, I mean, not great. So they slash his wrist like a hot dog, and two on the left wrist, one on the right wrist, and it's just stitched up. So it seems like
he had other stab wounds, and they leave him for dead. I don't know what happened. They got a call on the hamburger phone, and they had to go.
The hamburger phone.
Because he survived and he got stitched up, he was able to identify members of the gang.
Right.
And they were arrested and charged.
Until he mysteriously wrote himself a suicide note.
Right. In February of 1979, 11 members of the Shankill Butchers were convicted of 19 murders. And they were given 42 life sentences between all 11 of them.
Great. But it seems like they still did some murders for a few years after that.
Yeah, because plot twist, Murphy was behind bars on a weapons charge.
Oh, God.
So I think it might have even been for the broad daylight murder.
Oh, like they got him for the murder,
but they got him for the gun. And so he's in jail. And
so he couldn't have done it.
He doesn't get charged as being part of the Shankill Butchers. And then he's also protected by the Shankill Butchers.
In jail.
And he's released in 1982.
Great.
So, rewind to 1979, February 25th, a couple days after the butchers, not including Murphy, are sentenced and tried or charged. An article ran in the Sunday Press, and I'm going to read from that now.
Okay. I'm worried.
So, the journalism is always so funny when you look at it. So, okay. Now that the Shankill Butchers are behind bars, we talk to the widow of one of the victims who says she prays to God that he will help her to forgive those who gave the father of 13 children such an awful death.
13?
Oh, yeah. They had 16, one every year, but some of them died.
This man couldn't pull out of a driveway.
Wait, what was not the pullout method, the rhythm method?
The rhythm method, which is the same as the pullout method.
So William Moore, Samuel McAllister, and Arthur McClay killed with a knife, hatchet, and hammer this guy. The face was so grotesquely mutilated that it was beyond recognition. The head had been almost severed and was, quote, like a badly gashed cushion with the inside showing through the loose stitches, as Joseph Morrissey, 32, says he could not help thinking. And the very thought shocked him as he stood looking at it in the public morgue of Belfast's Forster Green Hospital. They had told him it was his father, Joe Morrissey Sr., but how could it be? His father was only 52 and without a gray hair on his head, yet this corpse had hair as white as snow. No, unless something terrible had happened to the effect, such a startling transformation overnight, it could not be. But something terrible indeed had happened. Joseph's brother Thomas gently opened the eyelids of the corpse, and those deep blue eyes could only be his father's. Thus was the formal identity of the body finally confirmed.
This seems kind of tenuous, actually. Right? I'd know those blue eyes anywhere.
And they're explaining that his hair went white because of what happened to him. Like, is that a thing? The Obama effect in speed up time?
While I'm getting stabbed, all of the hair is, all of the color is draining out of my hair.
I never saw that on SVU.
Well, I'm still in season 14 of SVU, so, you know.
It could come up.
It could come up.
There were,
you
back to the article.
You do see it in Twin Peaks, though.
You do?
Yes.
So is it real?
No, certainly not. Oh, Twin Peaks, okay. Not a documentary.
There were at least 13 major lacerations which had been made by a razor-sharp knife across and down the face, which was beaten to a pulp. There were 6 deep gashes. We should have done a trigger warning. Trigger warning!
Yeah, this is like a... This is pretty fucking graphic violence.
It's a weird, like, newspaper story, in my opinion. There were 6 deep gashes to the throat, V-shaped from ear to ear. The nose was all but cut off. The skull was fractured. His teeth had been torn out, and his fingers were broken. In the battered chest under the heart was a large stab wound, and the palm of each hand was pierced through as if by a long, thin knife. Jesus?
Yeah, but like, but they're not, but like, okay, so like, we're Protestant, we hate Catholics, so we're gonna kill people, and then we're gonna give them the stigmata because they're Catholic and we hate them, so we're gonna crucify them? I guess that makes about as much sense as anything else.
Sure. The legs, arms, and torso were black and blue and covered with congealed blood and bruises caused by heavy hammer and hatchet. And of the 40 or more different major injuries, any one of 17 could have been fatal.
Heavy hammer and hatchet sounds like a Decemberists album.
I think it is.
Oh, it's the one before Her Majesty's.
Joe Morrissey, van salesman of radios and TVs, father of 4 sons and 9 daughters, sons and daughters, and grandfather of 32 children,
come
was
on.
Last seen, Catholics, man, by his family.
This is why the Shankill Butchers are doing it. They're like, too many fucking people.
Population control.
Fucking tamp it down.
Okay, so yes, he was last seen by his family on February 2nd, 1977, when he left home in the afternoon to go to the National Club. He was arranging, among other things, to go to a boxing match. Boxing was one of his favorite sports.
Great.
On his way home that night, 2 of his killers, Samuel McAllister and Arthur McClay, stalked him in Upper Donegal Street. They bundled him into a car near St. Patrick's Church, where he loved to attend the 1 o'clock mass every day. Inside the car was the gang ringleader, William Moore, because remember, Lenny is in jail.
Right.
William Moore, driver and executioner. They drove to a house in the Shankill to pick up a gun, as one of them said, but no gun was available. Joe Morrissey, who was young looking for his age and whose hair was still dark auburn that night, though soon to turn white, was doomed to die anyway because he was Catholic. There was no other reason.
Ay. This is poorly written.
It's so hard to read. Joe was taken to a torture room that was once a doctor's surgery in the Shankill and which had been used by the sectarian killers on previous occasions to satiate their bloodlust on other Catholic victims.
Ay. Okay, sure.
Joe was their second to last such victim. He was prepared to meet his maker. Joe's wife, Mrs. Martha Morrissey, said he was a deeply religious man in a quiet way. He went to Mass and received Holy Communion, mostly in St. Patrick's, but sometimes in the Holy Family Church in Newington. Quote, Joe was not a religious crank who went around preaching with a pious face or anything like that. He was just a good man, a great family man, and he loved composing his own little prayers.
I don't know if Catholics are allowed to do that. You're not allowed to just make up your own little, like, there's a whole fucking book, right? With the,
you repeat
with the
it.
Latin and the, yeah. Like, I know a few things about Catholic. They're pretty strict with that stuff.
Joe is a rule breaker, okay?
Yeah, I guess so.
The margins and the white spaces of Joe's well-thumbed prayer book bore striking testimony to this. Written in were the short prayers he made up himself to augment the ones in print, and which he recited over and over again. Some of his prayers were possibly suggestive that he had some sort of premonition that his death would somehow be a trial.
Oh, yeah, because that's the only way that you can get a Catholic to talk about holy death and damnation and that kind of thing. Maybe death comes for all of us.
His wife said he once remarked to her when reading about the exploits of the Shankill killers, it's bad enough to be shot, but I wouldn't like to be caught by one of those butchers. Mrs. Morrissey said, you know, I often wonder how anybody could do such a thing to my Joe, who never did any harm to anyone in his life, but God is close to those who suffer and why we must try to forgive. It is very hard at times, but I pray to God to help me forgive.
I'm exhausted by this writing.
It's very hard to read. Here, her married daughter, Margaret, 25, interjected. No, I've sat in court and listened to the things they did to my daddy. I just can't forgive them. Not now, anyway. I think hanging would be too good for them, whether they were drunk or drugged or not.
We think that they're drugged. They're like zombies under the will of this crazy man. That's like the theory, right?
I guess. I mean, I think I did hear in if we're taking the December's word for it, the whiskey was getting drank by the pint.
Oh, sure, sure. Right. The whiskey is getting drank by the pint.
Quote, this is about Joe. He read a lot, and though he was a quiet man, again with the quiet, he could make himself heard and be firm when he wanted to. He loved children. I think the children have inherited his good looks. We had 16 children, one every year, but we lost 3.
Woof.
Joe, okay. Above all things.
Oh my God, this is still going.
Yes. Was a great family man. I feel like they're repeating themselves and I have
they are.
Cut out.
Every time I'm like, okay, we're bringing it's it in for a landing. Over. It's like Joe was a family man. His hair was dark, but soon turned gray.
So Joe's crumpled body was found near Glencaim Community Center, where other previous victims of the Shankill butchers have been dumped. A strange thing happened that fearful night in the Morrissey home in North Belfast. Mrs. Morrissey, who in the past had 4 warnings of deaths of her brother Charles and her mother, and whose children are sure she had premonitions, had been up waiting for her husband's return home and wondering. It was 2 a.m. My rosary beads were hanging over the holy water. In the bedroom, said Mrs. Morrissey. As I lifted them down on an impulse to bless myself with them, the crucifix, which had always been firmly attached, fell off onto the floor. I believe Joe died in that moment.
Okay, this is like, once again, this is the 70s. The Exorcist has come out. Like, these people have been poison-brained by, like, seeing The Exorcist, and they're like, the bed's moving, Joe's dead, and his hair's gone white. I don't even think Joe died. I think Joe fucking
Joe's
left his
ran away.
13 annoying-ass kids. It's like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, so RIP or not,
yeah,
Joe,
if he's a friend of the show, Joe, if you're still around. lyricsforlunch@gmail.com. But yeah, they're trying to make it like this. I mean, the story is sensational enough. Why try to make it like The Exorcist,
like,
or something?
That wasn't journalism.
Yeah.
That was so weird.
This is some Michelle Remembers ass shit.
Oh, yeah. So it's often been theorized that a number of the gang members escaped prosecution, and, you know, we know Lenny did, and that the death toll associated with them, which was 19, was much higher in actuality.
Sure, yeah.
So never forget that Lenny Murphy got out in 1982.
haven't forgotten.
Less than 24 hours after his release, he beat to death a man, Norman Maxwell, in a loyalist club, running him over repeatedly with his car.
In a loyalist club? Why?
Nobody knows.
Yeah, I mean, like, so this just proves, like, he's a little disgusting little shit boy. He just loves doing murders. It doesn't really matter.
More killings followed, and he apparently started assembling a new gang. A suspected UVF informer was shot in August. A UVF volunteer that Murphy got into an argument with was poisoned in September. I feel like Murphy didn't do the poisoning. That's not his style, but
right,
whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
From the History, Film, and Politics blog, Never Felt Better, quote, "Perhaps the final straw was Murphy's abduction, torture, and killing of Joseph Donegan, a Catholic civilian, in October of that year. Murphy took Donegan off the street ostensibly to demand the release of a UDR soldier who had been kidnapped by the Provisionals, but after subjecting Donegan to a relentless beating and allegedly the pain of removing most of his teeth with pliers, fuck, he seemingly watched on happily as the blameless victim was finished off with a shovel."
That sounds more like Murphy.
Yeah. Like poisoning.
But why is this the last straw?
Because Murphy was killed a month later, gunned down by a PIRA squad as he left his girlfriend's house.
For revenge for this one guy, or for revenge for everything? I guess last straw. The meaning implies there are other straws.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So the killing took place in a highly unionist area of Belfast, and the shooters seemed to have knowledge of Murphy's movements, whereabouts.
Yeah, he just got sloppy, I guess.
He went down in a rain of bullets.
Shit. Irish Scarface.
Quote, "Never felt better. Of course, the Butchers did not exist in a vacuum, with their tenure of terror on the streets of Belfast only part of the death toll of those years. But there is something especially chilling about them all the same. Murphy and his compatriots did not aim to merely kill their perceived enemies, Catholic or Protestant. They set out to hurt, mutilate, and ultimately kill in as grisly a fashion as possible. And there is a great deal of debate to be had as to how weighted their motivations were between sectarian hatred or just sheer psychopathy. They cut to the heart of the trouble's brutal reality, namely that a grisly kind of death could essentially occur to anyone at any time in those years, and the perpetrators could easily escape any form of conventional justice."
So eat your vegetables.
So this brings me to like the last thing that I have to say on this episode, which is like, this is so weird that it turned into like a cautionary tale for children to eat their vegetables. Because their victims were not children.
Actual dead people like bleeding out in the street. So yeah, I mean, so we are taking Malloy's word for it that he heard that people are doing this children's fairy tale thing.
Sure. We are.
I think that's like, you know, print the legend. Like, it's a fun thought experiment to do this. I don't know in practice how common it could have possibly been. Because once again, speaking to my own experience, my parents were like, "You know, you better eat all your vegetables or Hitler's going to come get you." Like, it's not, if there's actual threat of bodily harm from an actual murderer, or you kids, you better eat all your vegetables because Charles Manson will come get you. Like, I doubt that that happened regularly, because that's super traumatizing.
Yeah, I feel like that's abusive.
Yeah, which is like, not to say that it never happened. It's a big world. Basically everything happens. But I don't know if it's as common as Colin Malloy makes it out to seem in his Pitchfork quote.
Agreed. So we're going to hear from John McGurk of the Belfast Telegraph.
I thought that he was the drummer of the Decemberists.
The title of this article is "Kid Scaring Boogeyman? ? No Vicious Sectarian Murderers."
Okay.
"A song portraying cutthroat killers, the Shankill Butchers, as kid-scaring boogeyman has been condemned as, quote, really sick by a relative of one of the gang's victims.
As fucked up.
A U.S. band, the Decemberists, could be flying into a storm as a result when they arrive in Ireland in 2 months. The five piece are the toast of the American independent rock scene with their U.S. top 40 album, The Crane Wife, which includes Shankill Butchers. They play Dublin on October 9th. The band
we just missed it.
of the murdering loyalist psychopaths, quote, picking at their fingers with their knives and wiping off their cleavers on their thighs. The chorus warns children. Everybody knows if you don't mind your mother's words, a wicked wind will blow your ribbons from your curls. Everybody moan, everybody shake. The Shankill Butchers want to catch you awake. Lead singer Colin Molloy said that he had been inspired to write the song after reading about the Butchers in a biography of Van Morrison. Apparently, parents at the time, this is the quote that
we read earlier.
Use it as a cautionary tale. But a brother of one of the gang's victims told Sunday Life, the lyrics are really sick to me. I don't want to actually hear the song. The writer is trying to make the Shankill Butchers out to be just boogeymen who scared kids. If he thinks that, there must be something wrong with the guy's head. These were sectarian murderers. It's as simple as that.
I don't even know. I don't even think it's that simple. I think it's even more simple, which is like these guys were psychos. They flew whatever flag they could to do that. So it's like even more simple than sectarians. They were just fucking nutzos.
Yeah. They loved murdering.
Yeah.
So this man added, some bands come up with these sorts of things to be outrageous. I am not saying this band is trying to be outrageous, but they should be taking people's feelings into account as well. I think the song is really insensitive. The lyrics are very distasteful to the memory of innocent people like my brother.
Mm. This reminds me of our Preppy Murders episode, which like pulled the rug out of some people's under some people's feet that the killers had written the song about this, like this girl who died, and her family's like, please don't. And they're like, you know what, you're right. And they stopped doing it. They stopped playing it. And like, this is like a kind of a similar vibe where it's like a very academic experiment which has like real human emotions at the center of it that they're kind of ignoring.
And it would be one thing if it was like a super old story, like you thought, but the fact of the matter is
people are still alive.
A Shankill Butcher's family, victim's family, heard the song. So now you know.
So now I know. This was a total mind blower. I had no idea. I had no idea that this was a real thing, which is I think speaks to like how we want to sweep the certain historical things under the rug.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yikes.
So what are we going out on today?
I think we're going out on Sons and Daughters, which is the last song on The Crane Wife and a little bit more hopeful. The sons and daughters that went to bed and ate their vegetables, they get to now fill their mouths
cinnamon.
Eat cinnamon and fly on dirigibles. I love this song.
Me too.
This also has like weirdly tinged stuff about the Iraq war. There's like the last kind of refrain in the song is hear all the bombs fade away. And there's a song, I think on this record, called When the War Came, which is like very weird, like a little American Idiot adjacent, where we're like, this record isn't about like George W. Bush, and yet there are people like sneaking these kind of anti-war songs into otherwise really different records.
I thought it was the bumps fade away.
All
the bumps fade away.
Why would it be bumps?
My humps.
But you don't hear bumps. Very famously, you feel them.
I thought they were saying here.
Here, where we are. You know what? Let me just do a quick cross reference. Holy shit.
What? Am I right?
No, I'm just like, I am flabbergasted that's, you were just like, no further questions. This is what the song's about. I just sent you the lyrics to. What does it say there?
Here are all the bombs. They fade away.
Yeah, they do it like 24 times.
Where can people find us on the internet?
Find us on the internet at lyricsforlunch.com or Nope, I did it backwards. Lyrics for Lunch on Instagram and Twitter. And for longer and weirder stuff, shoot us an email at lyricsforlunch.com.
If you want to support the show,
if you want to buy me a new refrigerator,
go to lyricsforlunch.com and click support the show.
And tune in next week. Oh, tell your friends about us. Tell your enemies about us. Tell anyone you can, any way you can. And tune in next week when we do this all over again with another song that will make you go, huh.
Huh.
We should make them say, but turn it into make them say, huh.
Yeah. All right. Till next time.
I'm Aviv Rubenstein.
I'm Lindsay Tucker.
Saying, here, all the bumps fade away.